From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. And let's get right into politics, the future of President-elect Joe Biden's transition to the White House, and the already growing rift between progressive and moderate Democrats. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, a liberal Democrat from Washington State, joins us now. Congresswoman, good to speak with you.
It's great to speak with you as well.
And before we look forward, let's just take a moment to look back here, because in 2017, on the floor of Congress, you objected to the certification of the Electoral College vote for President Trump, citing voter suppression in Georgia. Do you expect that Republicans are going to try something similar in January, and would they be within their rights to do it?
Well, they definitely wouldn't be within their rights to do it. We've had all the secretaries of state, including Republican secretaries of state, saying there is absolutely no evidence of voter fraud at all. And so I think we should certify the election and we should get on to the transition.
Well, I know you're feeling good about this election and the outcome. I saw you banging a pot and pan on your front porch after the race was called for Joe Biden. But I am wondering how long the celebration will last, because after losing seats in the House this election, there is, as you well know, something of a rift in your party. The moderates, some of them are saying that progressives handed Republican opponents a gift when they started talking about defunding the police, Medicare for all, allowing Republicans to wield terms like socialism against them. What do you think about this? How's this tension affecting your party unity?
Well, I think it's probably overreported in the media, but, you know, I will say that every single incumbent Democrat who ran in a swing district on Medicare for all won their race. Almost every single one that ran on a Green New Deal won their race. And the defund the police, we had a really great conversation with Cameron Webb, who was running in Virginia 5th. They certainly ran that against him. My friend Max Rose, they ran that against him. Both of them lost, or, you know, Max is losing now. Both of them understand that that defund the police slogan was being used by Republicans, but it wasn't really because people in Congress were running on that slogan. It was because there was a real movement on the streets for justice, and neither of them regret that that movement for justice is happening. So Cameron made a really good point that, look, he ran hard against it, but at the end of the day, it was Republican turnout that drove those losses, not those slogans, which we know Republicans are going to use against us over and over again.
So is that what it is? I mean, because I know that Democrats are trying to do a postmortem here, wondering why they lost these seats in the House, didn't flip the Senate. I mean, who does get the blame for that? Or is it something else altogether?
I think there's two things. One is that many of those seats in the House that we won in 2018, we didn't expect to win. They were hardcore Republican districts. We ran great candidates, but Donald Trump was not on the ballot. And you have to say that he did a very good job of mobilizing and registering new voters this time around and driving them to the polls. So while our turnout was good, Republican turnout was excellent also.
Is that because Republicans did a really good job, say, knocking on doors where Democrats kind of held back up until the last very moment?
Yes, that was my second point, is I think we need to do more organizing all year round, not just right before the election. You know, I'm an organizer. That's how I came to Congress. And it matters when you are out organizing for 4 years or 2 years, not just 30 days.
And let's talk about how progressives are going to handle Joe Biden in the White House. How do you think he's going to navigate this split in the party that we've been talking about? And do you expect he's going to listen to you? I mean, after all, he said that he won the election precisely because he's a moderate.
Well, Joe Biden ran on the most progressive platform that any president has run on in recent history. And that was really because of progressives across the country who pushed hard. Many of us led or were on the unity task forces that came up with his ultimate campaign sort of commitments. And it includes things like My College for All Act with Bernie Sanders, making college free for families earning up to $125,000. It includes the National Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. It includes a very, very strong immigration platform. It includes an aggressive climate platform. So I think that these are all critically important pieces. $15 minimum wage, remember, when it passed here in Seattle, we were the first major city many years ago, it was considered a radical far left idea. This cycle, Florida, which went for Donald Trump, passed a $15 minimum wage, and we Democrats passed that in the House. So we've got to make sure that we continue to push. I always say that being progressive just means you are first to the best and most just idea.
And we'll see what luck you have getting those ideas through Congress, because, of course, it is still divided. Should Joe Biden put a Republican in his cabinet as an olive branch to the right?
You know, I think it's about who's going to deliver on these things that we've committed to. These are promises, and we were able to get a lot of young people, a lot of progressives, a lot of black and brown and immigrant voters out because we were able to translate for them the danger of Donald Trump and the White House and the fact that no progress is possible. But if we don't deliver for them in these next 2 years before the midterm elections, I fear we will lose them for a generation. I'm just saying it doesn't matter what the label is for the person as long as they're committed to working for those issues. There used to be Republicans 10 years ago who cared about immigration reform and infrastructure and putting people back to work and getting good jobs across the country. This Republican Party has really been incredibly obstructionist. But if there are people that are committed to delivering on real results for working people and fighting the biggest corporations, I'm fine with them being in the cabinet. I just care about what we deliver for the people.
Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, Democrat of Washington State, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Peter.
Let's go to Hong Kong, where pro-democracy lawmakers resigned today after four of their colleagues were kicked out of the legislature, the latest move in China's effort to clamp down on the independent movement in Hong Kong. You might remember the huge protests after Beijing proposed a new national security law for Hong Kong. It criminalized secession, subversion, and collusion with foreign forces. But law went into effect in June, and in response, the U.S. leveled sanctions on several officials, including Hong Kong's pro-Beijing leader. Several Western countries suspended their extradition treaties with the territory. China rejects all of the criticism, labeling it foreign interference. And the background for all of this is that Hong Kong is a former British colony, returned to China in 1997 under what's called the One Country, Two Systems principle, which allowed more rights and freedoms in Hong Kong than allowed in the Chinese mainland. But those rights and freedoms seem very much in jeopardy today. NPR's Emily Fang is following the story from Beijing. Emily, tell us more about Hong Kong this morning. Four lawmakers kicked out, the rest resigning.
Yes. So what happened was China's legislature met for a scheduled lawmaking session, and they passed a resolution Wednesday morning, Beijing time, saying that any lawmaker in Hong Kong who threatened China's sovereignty over the region, advocated for Hong Kong independence, or in some way, shape, or form threatened national security could be ousted by Beijing. And this decision did not have to go through Hong Kong courts. And the resolution that was passed by Beijing's legislature specifically pointed out these four Hong Kong lawmakers who had already been banned from running for re-election as contravening this resolution, and that they should be immediately unseated from Hong Kong's Legislative Council. So they were basically specifically named in the resolution. What's astonishing about this resolution, even though people saw it coming from a mile away, is that Hong Kong's legislature now effectively has no opposition. Mm. All the other pro-democracy opposition lawmakers have quit in protest to these four lawmakers being unseated. And so for the first time in history, you have a Hong Kong LegCo, Hong Kong Legislative Council, that is full of all pro-Beijing lawmakers.
We're seeing incredible pictures here, Emily, of all of these dissenting lawmakers joining hands, masked, fully masked against the, you know, COVID-19, but standing together strong in their dissent and their departure. But they also seem to me to look a little bit shaky. What is the mood there after this?
I think people are in shock. Again, we knew that this resolution was coming. We knew that China's legislature was meeting this week. At the same time, now that it's happened, it's hard to imagine a Hong Kong in which the chaotic, often divisive conversations that would happen within Hong Kong's legislative chamber are no longer going to happen again because there is no opposition lawmaking bloc in the Legislative Council. These lawmakers are taking a risk by resigning in protest. At the same time, this resolution gives Beijing effective veto power in which lawmakers were allowed to stand on the legislature. So at some point, they saw the writing on the wall and knew that at some point they would probably be kicked out by Beijing anyways. And they're making quite a strong statement today by resigning.
And what about outside the legislature? Does this leave the pro-democracy movement, you know, is it over?
Unfortunately, the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong itself was over as soon as the national security law was passed this June. The national security law, which you mentioned in your introduction, outlawed basically all forms of meaningful dissent. That being said, a lot of Hong Kong diaspora and activists who are seeking refuge or have already gone into voluntary exile in Europe and the US, they're keeping their activism alive and they've started organizations there. So expect to see a lot of Hong Kong issues in the news, but much of that protest is not going to happen in Hong Kong anymore.
NPR's Emily Fang, watching Hong Kong from Beijing. Emily, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
On this Veterans Day, on a split-screen TV image, President-elect Joe Biden paid a surprise visit to a wreath laying in Philadelphia, just as President Trump arrived at Arlington National Cemetery for his first public appearance since the election. And after a week in which he roiled the Pentagon, firing the Secretary of Defense and installing loyalists, and a week in which he refused to concede to Biden. In today's Washington Post, John Podesta, former chief of staff to President Bill Clinton, and Andrew Card in the same role for George W. Bush, argue together that delayed transitions are life-threatening. Card said the contested 2000 election hampered the Bush administration in getting national security advisors in place just before the 9/11 attacks that killed 3,000 Americans. So what's the strategy now? Well, our political strategists are here. Jamal Simmons is the Democrat. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And Alice Stewart, the Republican. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Robin. Always great to join you.
Well, and I got to get right to you, Alice. Today on our program, we also heard former Secretary of Defense William Cohen, a Republican, say President Trump is also allowing Americans to die of a virus. We haven't heard one word about it from this administration. Combine that with the delay in transition. Is President Trump endangering American lives?
There are a lot of different aspects of this. The most important is the election process and the integrity of the election. And look, I think we should let every legal vote be counted. But there are still things that need to be done. Clearly, the administration is still addressing the coronavirus epidemic, whether or not they're talking about it publicly or working in private. But also, there are certain things that the incoming administration needs to do, but Trump's refusal to concede shouldn't impact it overall. And truthfully, until the election results are certified officially, there should be limited access to certain information and data, except for President-elect Biden. But I still think we can have a peaceful transfer of power, given that the action begins when the results are certified.
Alice, I gotta jump in. That has never happened. I mean, in 2000, when it was a much closer race, the contest in just one county, Republicans immediately congratulated Bush. No one waited. Jamal, jump in here. The Republicans are saying every vote should be counted.
Of course, every vote should be counted. And what happens is, as the votes get counted, Vice President Biden's lead grows and grows. He's now up to 5 million votes in the popular vote. He's got 279 electoral votes minimum. It could go up to 306. The president has 217. Donald Trump is nowhere near becoming president of the United States again. It's time for us to move on. And if you look at recent polls, there's an Ipsos Reuters poll out that has about 79% of Americans are also ready to move on. So let's get the Vice President Biden. Let's get President-elect Biden the briefings that he needs and Vice President-elect Harris. Let's start submitting names to be FBI background checked so that they could get confirmed. And then let's start getting people into the government so we can understand what an orderly transition looks like and get the government ready to go in January.
Well, and I just have to say, I misspoke. Hold on, Alice, because I misspoke. I said 2000. I meant 2016. In 2016, when President Trump, didn't even win the popular vote, he lost by 3 million votes. everybody accepted that there are votes that are always counted afterwards. But once you hit that 270 in the electoral votes, Republicans immediately in 2016 congratulated Donald Trump. Is it? I mean, the whiff of hypocrisy. You don't smell that here.
Robin, look, let me be quite clear. I do think that when you hit 270, then the results are in and the president-elect should be declared. But clearly this president wants to make sure that every legal and legitimate vote is counted. Look, I'm former Deputy Secretary of State in Arkansas. I have tremendous respect for the integrity of these elections. And I've always had a problem with this administration questioning the integrity. And I truly believe, and serious Republicans do believe, that until we see evidence of widespread Democratic rigging of the process, the administration and the president needs to silently respect the count or concede. Those are the two options. But what my point is, he wants to make sure every legitimate vote is counted. He has the right to do so, but there are many that do see the writing on the wall, and it's time to move forward.
Well, but is this really about counting votes, Alice? I just want to ask you about the strategy, because we heard William Cohen say he thinks it's about roiling things up so that Joe Biden, you know, is handed a mess. James Pindell writes in the Boston Globe today, he's seen the fundraising emails. He says this is about paying off campaign debt and raising funds and fear, undermining faith in voting so that they can use that money and that fear to change voter laws. When, in fact, as we said, this election went off beautifully. I think the Trump administration is 0-for-12 on their request to courts to turn back some of this voting. So it seems to have gone off without a hitch so far. What is the strategy here, Alice?
It's obviously clearly to sow doubt on the outcome of these elections and sow division within the country, which I think is certainly a bad precedent. I think there is a way to go about making sure that the 71 million voters that cast their votes for this president have their votes counted. But there needs to be a time and a point when we recognize that the decision has been made. And we do need to, as Joe Biden says, let's bring about unity and work together to have a peaceful transition of power. And I think respecting the election process is just as critical to a peaceful transition of power. And that's part of democracy, which is much more important than any one person.
Jamal, I want to ask you about Biden. Go ahead.
Yeah, I never disagree with James Pindell if I don't have to. He's one of the smartest guys in politics in the Northeast that I know. But let me just say, you know, there's a list of Republicans who have already come out and said this thing is settled, including former President George W. Bush and Condoleezza Rice and a few governors and senators and former governors and senators. Every living president, we're past the point now. We are past the point where everybody recognizes that the New York Times surveyed every single secretary of state or election official's office in the country and found none of them who would say there was any kind of fraud in the election, and most of them who said it's time to move on, including the secretary of Montana, who said, bite your lip, tip your hat, and, you know, and say, congratulations, Mr. President, it's time to go. I think this is a effort to do something else, and it's becoming more and more worrisome, not just about fundraising, but the removal of people from the Department of Defense, the changing of the guard in their national security establishment. It makes many reasonable people wonder what exactly this president, who's been so outside the normal bounds of presidencies, what is he up to?
Alice, what is that strategy?
Clearly, certain of employment decisions that he made, obviously recently letting people go, were decisions he wanted to make weeks and months ago, but it wasn't in the best interest of the campaign. And he's clearly just removing people that he has wanted to let go and doing so in a time that wouldn't impact the election. I see part of it is getting even with people that may have disagreed with him, but he's the president of the United States, and he has the right and the authority to move people around however he sees fit.
Let me just jump in here. I'm sorry. Let me just jump in here, because it can't just be about him being the president of the United States. It's got to be about what's best for the people of the United States. And if whether or not it was good for the campaign or not, removing a Secretary of Defense this close to transition, changing the security apparatus, perhaps removing a CIA director and an FBI director, this all smells of something very dark. And I think we have got to put the people's interest of the United States forward, even though this president has never been the most patriotic person who's put people ahead, the people of the country ahead of his own personal needs, at this point, we've just got to, because we're all at risk from adversaries looking for holes in our defenses.
Alice, why haven't more Republicans spoken up about, you know, installing loyalists in the Pentagon? As Jamal said, it seems like such an autocratic thing to do. Are they frightened to cross Donald Trump because he may run in 2024, which is the whisper, or they may, and he will not bring his base to support them? Why aren't we hearing from more in-office Republicans? We're hearing from plenty who are out.
Well, in-office elected officials, Republicans and Democrats, whether they're on the state level or federal level, realize that anyone who works for the president serves at the will of the president, and he has the authority to bring in whoever he wants, whether you want to term them as loyalists or lifelong military experts. He has the authority to put in positions whomever he wants. And for them to question that goes against certainly the obligation and the responsibility and privilege they have in elected office to appoint people to work for them at their will. And that's exact the same responsibility and right that our president has.
Jamal, I'm going to give the last minute to you to ask you about, do the Democrats have their own wound to heal? They lost seats in the House when they'd predicted gains. Republicans actually had a great election night down ballot. We heard the leaked phone call among Democrats. You know, no more mention of the word socialism. Many of the moderates thought that that was what did them in. But then you have progressives like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez saying, no, we're the ones who actually helped. How does this get healed?
This is one of these situations like, in many conflicts around the world, everybody's got something right to say and everybody's got something wrong. The reality is the language that was used in some of these campaigns, how the Republicans attacked using socialism and defund the police, was hurtful to some moderate Democrats. The challenge, though, for the moderate Democrats is, if you're not for defunding the police, what are you for that's going to help curtail police violence? If you're not for Medicare for all, what are you for that's going to lower health care costs and expand coverage? That's the challenge for these two politicians.
And that's the conversation. Jamal Simmons, the Democrat, Alice Stewart, the Republican. Thanks, as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, November 17th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
As we get closer to an approved coronavirus vaccine, some health experts believe communities of color that have been hardest hit by the pandemic should be prioritized when distributing the first doses. Nicholas St. Fleur is a reporter with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. He's on Skype and he joins us now. Nicholas, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And tell me about this call to move people of color to the front of the line when a vaccine comes out. What's the thinking behind it?
Right. So the idea here is that communities of color have been some of the hardest hit communities by COVID-19. Some medical and public health officials have been calling to make sure that when a vaccine is given out, it's given out equitably. In my story, I quote Lawrence Gostin, who is a professor of global health law at Georgetown University, and he puts it quite bluntly, saying, having a racial preference for a COVID-19 vaccine is not only ethically permissible, but I think it's an ethical imperative. From our understanding, Black Americans are 3 times as likely as white Americans to contract COVID-19, and also 5 times as likely to end up in the hospital, and twice as likely to die from it.
So we'll get to some of the ethical questions here in just a minute. But first of all, how would you determine how to do this? I mean, how would you do it? Would you have to like zero in on a zip code or something? How would it work?
Right. So in the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, in their guidelines, they're basically saying that you need to look at particular communities and assess them on certain social indexes. So the idea, it's called the Social Vulnerability Index. And that looks at poverty rates, that looks at health insurance rates. So the idea here is not to do it such that, you know, if there's a white person in line and a black person in line, you would only give the vaccine to the black person. That is not how they are looking at it. They are looking particularly at communities that are hardest hit by this.
What are some of the legal questions that might hinder this?
That's a great question. And as Lawrence Gostin had said, that's his biggest concern, that if you put forth any of these recommendations and you include something that says that it needs to be equitable or that race and ethnicity need to be taken into account, that this would just create a legal problem where basically any kind of distribution of the vaccine is tied up in some kind of tied up in the courts, as he put it. So the issues here is that, as I mentioned earlier, you can't do something where you would take someone out of line for a vaccine based off of their race. So the issue is, if this isn't communicated properly, people might think that's the approach that, you know, the vaccine distribution centers will be taking, which is not what is being advocated here.
Well, not only that, I mean, some people of color might be skeptical of a plan like this because not everybody wants to be the first in line. And as you know, there's some historical distrust here.
Exactly. Thank you so much for bringing that up. Vaccine hesitation, especially amongst communities of colors and black communities, is, from the health experts I've spoken to, the biggest concern that health professionals have with the vaccine distribution. So the communication campaign needs to be very strong, talking about the effectiveness of this vaccine before it is rolled out.
That was Nicholas St. Fleur, Knight Wallace Reporting Fellow at Stat News. Nicholas, thanks so much for your reporting. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
On this Veterans Day, we want to share the story of a man who went the extra mile to honor his friends at war. Actually, John Chickie Donahue went over 8,800 miles from New York City to Saigon on a boat. You may have heard about this. It started one night in 1967 when Chickie was 26 on a stool at Doc Fiddler's, a favorite neighborhood bar in the Inwood section of Manhattan, a close Irish enclave. The bartender, called the Colonel, was outraged at anti-Vietnam War protesters in Central Park. He and others saw them as anti-soldier, and many soldiers were from their neighborhood. The Colonel's solution? Bring those boys a beer. Hurrah, was the response. Wait, what? Bring them a beer in a war? Chickie volunteered. He'd been a Marine, had been in country twice before as a merchant seaman. He soon found work on a cargo ship going to Vietnam. Miraculously, once there, found many of the boys, as they were called, 19, 20 years old. But then things went south, or the South went south. That was Chickie hugging a wall outside the embassy in Saigon as he was attacked in the Tet Offensive. Soon, he was stuck in Vietnam. Chickie Donahue's story has been told in a YouTube documentary and now in the new book, The Greatest Beer Run Ever. And no surprise, a feature film is being planned by Oscar-winning writer-director Peter Farrelly. And John Chickie Donahue joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here talking to you.
Okay. What on earth were you thinking?
I don't know. I was thinking I was, by that time we had already buried 26 or 28, I forget the exact number, from the neighborhood, all victims of the war. So it was the right thing to do. So let me try. Yeah. At least I can try.
Well, and as you write, in your neighborhood, people didn't have doctor friends who could get you out of the draft with things like bone spurs. So you get to Vietnam, beer stashed in a fridge on the ship. You ask for shore leave for 3 days and you get it. And somehow hitch copter rides up to where your friends are, wearing, you know, corduroy pants and a Madras shirt. People thought, what, you would be the CIA?
Yeah, well, in the beginning, they didn't know what I was. In a port, they see American civilians. But out in the field where the military was, they didn't see any civilians. So when they saw you there, they assume you're some sort of government agent. What kind of government agent? They could think anything from a CIA to a repairman. I don't know. But the longer I was there, I became aware that they're deferring to me and they didn't stop me. And I knew the lingo from being in the Marines. So it just worked.
I love some of the exchanges you know, everybody wants to be a part of some excitement. And so you'd say, I need to get up to whatever, the forward thing with the battalion two and the such and such, right on the, everything was a front line, but, you know, right in the middle of the fighting. And someone would say to you, yes, sir, you know, what's going on? Like you, and yes, you knew. And then you started to tell people, I'm bringing beer to a friend from home. And they'd wink like, you know, code, it's code or something. When they did figure it out, people thought you were crazy.
Well, you see, the lower ranked guys up to a sergeant, I would tell the truth, or I could tell the truth. And they sort of like, they helped me in their way. They were sort of beating the system. They got a kick out of that. And some of them actually said, I wish I had somebody from my old neighborhood over here. I could use them. But officers, I wouldn't tell the truth. But I would say, if I told you the truth, you would not believe me. I got away with it.
Yeah, you did. You found friends like Rick Duggan, who's right in the middle of a really tense situation. And what I love is, you know, you brought the beer, yeah, but also news from home. You know, the troops you met, they wanted to know, did Vince Lombardi retire? Did Jefferson Airplane have a new album? I mean, they were so hungry for that.
Before I made the trip, I went to see, one of the mothers whose son, Tommy Collins, Mrs. Collins, came to the bar, Doc Fiddler's, to give me Tommy's address and to tell me all about, she prays for him and whatever. And then I went up to see Mrs. Dugan, and Betty Dugan, her maiden name was, I've known her since before she was married. And then I went to Bobby Pappas's father, who was a local bartender, and he told me this and told me that. I forget exactly what they all told me, but I went over and delivered those messages to the guys. But the guys were also receiving letters from a group of the young girls in the neighborhood. And they put together like a monthly newsletter. It was just another effort to communicate to them over there. We did lose so many guys. We were very much aware of the danger that they were in, and we cared for them.
Well, it was 28. And when you think about 28 young men, you know, like we're talking under 23 usually, from one neighborhood, the cost of the war. But we'll get to that. I just, you mentioned Tommy Collins' mom. The YouTube documentary reunited you with several of the men you brought beers to years later. And we do have a little from Tommy Collins. Let's listen.
I'm looking over the ship, and the next thing is I see Chickie Denny. I said, what the hell are you doing here? He says, I came to see you. That's exactly what you said.
He asked me who I was with. I said, I'm with you.
He's in a combat zone, and here he is walking around like he's going on a golf outing or wherever the hell he's going, eh?
Yeah, because you had that Madras shirt. Look, it got dangerous. You know, you were in a firefight with Rick. And you have no weapon. You miss your ship. Your ship leaves without you. Now you've got to figure out how to get back. It's the Vietnamese New Year. Everyone's so excited. We know, instead of the truce that the U.S. expected, the Viet Cong launched attacks across the country, including in Saigon. That's when you were flattened against an embassy wall, watching people killed all around you. At this moment, what are you thinking?
I said, oh, my God. And now I was stuck. There was firing all around, and I had to wait until they cleared out the embassy, which took a couple hours. But when I finally got into the embassy and found somebody who knew of my case, he said everything. They had the airfield. I couldn't go anywhere that day, and now I know I'm stuck. I'd already been stuck there for weeks and weeks. Now it was going to be even longer. That's, that's the hand I was dealt.
Well, you also watched the whole battle, and you saw that the handful of young Americans posted at the embassy didn't have the backup they needed. There weren't enough of them.
No.
And they fought so valiantly. We know these stories. They fought so valiantly. So, look, you're a guy from the neighborhood who also resented the anti-war protesters. But it seems as if, you tell me if I've got this right, the end of this long journey that you took changed some of your thinking as well. Not that you didn't agree entirely with how the protesters went about what they were doing, but you understood they were trying to stop the war, and you were there. And you saw that generals like Westmoreland were saying things that weren't true, that didn't match with what you saw on the ground.
It wasn't worth it. It was a political dispute. And they were trying to settle their political dispute with the blood of young Americans. And that hurt. And they were lying to us. And I'm a proud Marine.
Semper Fi.
Semper Fi. Yeah. I was hurt over that. So, yes, it did change my life. But shortly after that, when I'm back in the States, I saw that American veterans were beginning to demonstrate with those demonstrators against the war. Mm-hmm. And that nailed it, that they were right. I'd like to say one more thing.
Please.
Some good things come out of this. One is that the four guys that I saw over there, I still speak to. We get together every once in a while, and they're all part of the book, the movie, the whole nine yards. Before I got to see, I had six. Reynolds was killed while I was over there, and Joe McFadden was sent home. He had a real bad malaria, so they sent him home a little early, and he missed my trip. But the fact that they're alive, we can talk about it now. It's great. It's great. God's been good to us. Oh, yes, one more thing. There was one young guy who was killed over there. His name was Thomas Minogue, and they gave him the second highest military award they could give. He deserved the Medal of Honor if anybody read the reports.
He threw his body on another soldier to save the other soldier. Yeah,
and he gave his life for his country, and what a great kid he was. And it was Johnny Knuth. I could sit here and go through all the names. It was McCormick and McGoldrick, and it was just sad. It was sad. But the ones I saw came back, and there was a lot of love there. Still is.
That's John Chickie Donahue, who tells the story of his trip to Vietnam to deliver beer in the greatest beer run ever. It's out this week. Chickie, thank you so much.
Thank you for telling this story. And Semper Fi to all the Marines out there, and happy Veterans Day to all my other brothers and sisters.
So I just have to say, because I was brought up that I always have to say this, my dad, Guadalcanal.
God bless him.
Another day in the pandemic, and the records just keep falling. Yesterday, the U.S. counted more than 136,000 new cases of the coronavirus. It has never been that high in a single day. Today, more Americans are hospitalized with the disease than ever before, and Texas has now become the first state to surpass 1 million cases. Gene Ross is co-president of National Nurses United, which represents more than 150,000 registered nurses across the country. She's based in Bloomington, Minnesota. Gene, welcome to Here and Now.
Glad to be here.
Well, and as these numbers surge, it's important to remember that for people like you, this is a workplace issue. How vulnerable do you feel when you start your work shift each day?
I think all of our nurses feel extremely vulnerable. We have always had to struggle with our employers, because we have a profit-based system in this country, as to how much staff we need and whether we have enough equipment. But I think most of us believe that should it come to something as critical as a pandemic, that people would be protective of us, our employers, our government. And right now, the only hope that we have is that the public keeps helping us pressure those entities, because we are not being well cared for. And we feel like we've been fed to the lions.
Mm. Well, so just over the border from where you are in Minnesota, the governor of North Dakota just recently announced that healthcare workers infected with COVID-19 who are not showing symptoms would be allowed to continue caring for COVID patients in places like hospitals and nursing homes. It's gotten so bad that these are the types of conversations that governors and hospitals are forced to have now. But do you think that it's a good way to deal with the staffing shortages that your industry is facing?
Well, I think the public needs to understand that we started from behind when it came to staffing. So no, it isn't proper to be talking about using healthcare workers, nurses or others, that are asymptomatic but test positive, because they are one of the worst spreaders. That's one of the things that makes this virus so unique. And if you have it, you can spread it. So it's highly irresponsible for an employer to ask that of a nurse. And it was highly irresponsible for the CDC to keep downgrading its recommendations, such as that one.
Well, you do make a good point. The CDC has said this would be an acceptable alternative in the face of staffing shortages. But there may be change coming. And I know that you're pleased and your group is pleased that President-elect Joe Biden is prioritizing the pandemic already. As you know, he's announced a task force to address the issue even before he gets to the White House.
Well, he and Kamala Harris
appear to be taking it very seriously. Just putting the group together of sane, rational individuals with knowledge is helpful, people who believe in science. Saying that we will have a coordinated response is something we have needed, since we nurses started talking about it in January before anybody took it seriously. We need somebody responsible that we can rely on. So we're very happy about that. We will have to continue to hold their feet to the fire, and we will continue to push for measures that this pandemic has shown us this country needs, and one of them is Medicare for all.
I hear you, and Joe Biden isn't going to be in the White House until January, so that's
correct.
Still a couple of months off. What's the danger lurking in that gap of time?
Well, you know, it's very hard to say when someone is as ill as this president is, Mr. Trump. It's hard to say what they're going to do next. We're hoping, of course, that there are still some people there who can keep an eye on him. But so far, he appears to have washed his hands of the virus, any talk about it, any plans for it. It's, again, irresponsible. It's quite repulsive to think that the president of the country doesn't care whether we live or die. I think Joe Biden can, even though he's not president yet, he's the president-elect, he can get through to people who might be able to get things in place so that we can start on day one when he is ensconced. That's my hope.
Yeah. And, you know, this is a heavy time, no doubt about it. Before I let you go, just briefly, how are you doing? You okay?
So your nurses are stressed, just like other healthcare workers. And, well, let's be frank, even people in the grocery stores, other frontline workers in meatpacking plants, we're all very stressed. We're used to death. We're not used to seeing so much on a daily basis. And when bodies start piling up in morgues again, as they are in El Paso, it eats at your heart. And you have to kind of push that aside and do your job, or the patients that you have in the public are in even more danger. So we'll keep our spirits up, but we are telling the public, you need to listen to us and to the scientists. You really do. You need to mask. Masking saves lives. Staying apart saves lives. So we don't have to be guessing anymore. We know what to do.
Jean Ross, co-president of the National Nurses United, the largest union of registered nurses in the country. Thanks for what you do.
You're
we would be
welcome.
In a much worse place without you.
Well, as you said, it's what we do.